Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Kevin McLenathan.
And I'm Sarah Welch Larson, and I'm looking forward to all these movies we have on deck today.
Hi, I'm looking forward to all these movies we have on deck today. I'm Dad.
Oh, no. Kevin just launching right into all of the bad dad jokes. I'm excited about this.
Dad jokes are appropriate for an episode where we focus on dad movies. This week, we've got a couple of great ones for you. First up is the franchise sequel that almost wasn't, Tom Cruise's Top Gun Maverick.
And then following up with that, we have The Right Stuff, in which Kevin and I are going to prove whether or not we also have the right stuff by trying to figure out if we can get all of these other bad dad jokes to take flight.
We're going to shoot the moon here on Seeing and Believing, episode 335. Stick around for more.
What kind of mission is this?
Everyone here is the best there is. Who's going to teach us?
Today we'll start with what you only think you know.
Nice.
What the hell?
Easy, Maverick. Let's try not to get fired on the first day.
We're going into combat on a level never seen.
You think up there you're dead. Believe me.
My dad believed in you. I'm not going to make the same mistake.
Yes, we're here on episode 335 of Seeing and Believing, and I don't think we've quite exhausted our reserve of dad jokes from that opening there, so...
Oh, no, no. Although, from one non-dad to a regular dad, you better get used to this.
I kind of see this episode as a training ground, as you will, the Top Gun of dad jokes, because...
Yes.
I feel like I need to really bone up on that stuff and become proficient fast, because... The day is coming when my son's going to expect certain things from me as a father.
We'll get you airborne on that eventually.
All right.
Yeah.
Good to hear. Listeners, we are going to be talking about a couple of movies that, if not the quintessential dad movies, they are at least movies that would play well for dads everywhere. we might get into a little bit later exactly what defines a dad movie and what makes them, but needless to say, I think that both of the movies we're going to be talking about are worthy entries in that subgenre.
Good grist for the mill, for sure.
So The Right Stuff is coming up in the second half of the segment, but let's jump right into a movie that I frankly was not sure was ever going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
This is the sequel to the original Top Gun titled Top Gun Maverick. It had some production woes that was kind of in the works for a while. I didn't think it could happen, but it's here, and we're going to talk about it on the episode today. This movie finds Tom Cruise's Pete Mitchell, aka Maverick, recently grounded after pushing a jet past Mach 10 and wrecking it. He returns to the Top Gun flight school, this time not as a hotshot, swaggering young ace, but as an instructor tasked with preparing the younger generation of hotshots for a near-impossible mission to destroy a uranium enrichment site. So, Sarah, this is a weird case of... I feel like a big aspect of Tom Cruise's persona is sort of the eternal youth. He never seems to age on screen, and yet this is a movie that is kind of about Maverick's coming to terms with the fact that he is aging, and to some extent the world is kind of passing him by. And I'm kind of curious to know how that works for you, this being a franchise sequel. Do you think that it pays off that the possibilities inherent in that premise, or do you think that it falls into the category of fan service for big time fans of Top Gun.
Oh man, and the big time fans of Top Gun thing is just such an interesting concept. It's funny, I feel like Top Gun's having a bit of a resurgence in the public. I don't know, I at this point, and I feel really weird about that, specifically because I have a very weird relationship with Top Gun, the original movie, just as a watcher. When I'm not actively watching it, worst movie ever. When I am actively watching it, coolest movie I've ever seen. And it was interesting sitting down and watching this sequel as kind of a franchise follow-up. There's a lot of very, like, I don't know, specific homage to the original in this movie. A lot of callbacks to the original screenplay. And at the same time, I feel like it actually almost kind of pulls it off because it takes those homages and it does something new with them. It's not just a case of somebody's going to say a line or a catchphrase. Someone's going to say, I feel the need for speed. And then that's just going to be it. There are references to the original movie and they are used to call attention to the fact that Maverick is aging and he's grown as a human being in the last 30 years. I would certainly hope that he had, because otherwise he would be a very uninteresting character. But the movie's doing interesting and creative stuff with those homages, I think, for the most part, which honestly surprised me because I was really expecting this to be mostly just fan service and a lot of planes flying really, really fast. So how did it strike you?
This movie is way, way better than it has any right to be. I mean, I don't know what to say. I went into Top Gun Maverick fully expecting it to be the latest in a long line of fan service nostalgia fests, where the only reason that you would get any enjoyment out of it at all is that you have some sort of buy-in to the original cultural artifact. And the main reason you're in the seat is you kind of want to relive a little bit of that magic once again. Even if it's not new, it's enough for it to retread the same ground, hit some of the same beats, have some of those nice catchphrases that we all remember so fondly from when we were 10-year-olds catching a little bit of it on cable TV. So I was frankly blown away by the fact that I think this is a pretty thoughtful movie for what it is. I mean, it is a summer blockbuster. It's not the deepest movie in the world, but I think that within those constraints, it does do some pretty interesting things with Tom Cruise's persona as an actor, the character of Maverick himself, and just sort of the way he is and what that might look like for in somebody who is 50 years old instead of 25 years old. And it maybe says a little bit also about just the United States, kind of moving on from the youthful flush of our military might in the Cold War, the 80s especially, and kind of to a new era where we're a little bit more aware of our own frailties and a little bit more aware that we're not going to be the top dog forever. And I the fact that this movie does hint at all those things while also kind of delivering the goods in terms of just summer blockbuster thrills, I think is very impressive.
Yeah. It's interesting because I found myself just a little bit unsatisfied with some of the figuring of where we are as a country versus who these characters as pilots are, because I didn't quite get that consideration of us not necessarily being the top dog anymore. There is an unnamed adversary on the global stage in this movie, and it is kind of unspoken to be Russia, which I think is the case in the original movie as well. And there was a level of like, we're just going to set up a uranium enrichment plant that's set off in this like other country as this unnamed adversary and we have to destroy it. And then there's no interrogation of any of the context around that situation at all whatsoever. And so that kind of still felt like this movie is treating, I don't know, the American military as the world's police. And that just felt a little bit gross to me personally, but like, I don't know. It's a complicated situation and it's kind of hard to boil that down into a blockbuster popcorn movie too, you know?
I mean, the thing about Top Gun, and this is probably just kind of the franchise's Achilles heel, is that it's hard to tell a story about the military that gives the, like, the military something to do that doesn't involve, like, going out there somewhere and blowing up stuff and maybe killing some quote unquote bad guys. So to some extent, I think that weakness is baked into the material. It is kind of politically toothless, because if you can't have any specificity about who this enemy is and why exactly it is the United States military's job to go out and blow them up, then it's hard to take a whole lot of its political commentary seriously. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, the specifics of the politics are kind of toothless, and that's partly why it's going to make tons of money, is because no matter what your politics are, you're going to have a good time with this, and you can root for our heroes because there's not enough specificity about what they're doing to have anything to root against. Mm-hmm. That said, I think that the fact that If we think of the characters of the original Top Gun as being somehow emblematic of the way that Americans like to see ourselves as sort of as young, as powerful, likable, the heroes of our own story, then it's interesting to see this movie kind of tweak that a little bit. So it's telling that whereas the romantic subplot in the first one maybe doesn't give the female character a whole lot to do in this
Nothing
one.
Whatsoever.
Yeah. Jennifer Connelly's Penny in this film, again, she's kind of relegated to a subplot. She doesn't have a ton to do, but the role that romance plays in the overall narrative, where Maverick has to come to terms with the fact that he's not sort of the love him and leave him type, that his romancing of this character has real consequences and has had fallout in the past. I think that is used to comment on perhaps his other exploits as well. But maybe I'm just reading too much into it.
I mean, also just better chemistry overall between Tom Cruise.
I mean, Jennifer Connelly, she's quite an actress. Maybe a slight upgrade, but she's working with stronger material too, to be fair.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think in Top Gun Maverick specifically, I think that the other characters are also allowed to have a little bit more depth. So original Top Gun, it's all fairly stock characters. You have your hotshot pilots, you have your teachers who are kind of, by the book and very strict. And that's about all that there is to the movie. And in this one, I think there is additional levels of depth that are given to some of the more background characters, and then also additionally, like, recognition that everybody who is being strict about the rules is because they have concerns for the lives that are underneath them as well. So John Hamm plays a two-star admiral who is very strict about what Tom Cruise's Maverick can and can't teach his students, and he has rules in place specifically to help safeguard their lives. And that's not really something that's ever really a consideration in the original movie. And I think this one, it's a lot about death-defying, like, stunts and death-defying, like, flight and being the fastest man alive, essentially. But it's also a lot to do with the level of safety and the safeguards that are needed in order to be able to get to that point so that you can then come home from the mission alive. And that's a consideration that I just don't think that you necessarily get when you're a young, dumb 25-year-old. But when you are a 50-year-old who has had that life experience and who can think about those sorts of things, that's something that you're much more willing to consider. So it gives a little bit of maturity and depth, I think, to the story.
Yeah, it stands as a contrast to the original as well, whereas the original, the fate of Goose is sort of the one stratagem that movie has for sort of complicating the war is fun kind of rah-rah military thing. Like, war is not always fun in games because, hey, this one guy died. Yeah. Whereas this Top Gun Maverick, I was really pleased to see that a lot of its central tension is in not just accomplishing the mission and, you know, letting our heroes have their hero moment, but also bringing them home safe and making sure that that's a definition of success as well. John Hamm's character in training, he's very obsessed with the safety of the equipment and of the pilots. That's only because he needs them to complete the mission, and it doesn't particularly matter to him whether or not the pilots come home, so long as the mission is completed. The mission is the number one priority for John Hamm, mm-hmm. whereas Tom Cruise's Maverick, he wants both, and it's important to him to make the success of the mission contingent on the, you know, all the pilots coming home alive. And that grows out of the first film's the death of Goose, mm-hmm. but the way that it's incorporated into this film, it doesn't feel like simply, oh, this is some of the history that all the fans know. It's woven into the character's motivations and the narrative development as well, in a way that I thought was, you know, for a franchise sequel that's coming decades after the fact, mm-hmm. I'm pretty impressed by that.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious to know what your thoughts are about Tom Cruise's character in particular, especially with that concern for life, because I feel like a lot of what he's doing here is kind of playing counter to his public persona of, I'm going to do a lot of death-defying stunts and I am going to be the one to do them specifically. I feel like we get a little bit of that interrogation in Mission Impossible Fallout, sort of, but this feels like it's a little bit more in depth to me. So I was curious to know like what you think about that.
Good question. I think, I don't know. It's hard to say how much of that is the movie being intentionally interrogating it, and how much of it is just because the screenplay is written this way, it's allows us to make that connection without necessarily explicitly inviting us to. I do think that the restraint, probably in terms of not having him be the devil may care person we know and maybe love from the first movie, is mainly a consideration of just what's good storytelling. When we finally do see Maverick sort of hop in that jet and show everyone how it's done at the Top Gun school, and make, you know, the Kessel run in 5 parsecs or whatever the line is, that moment is genuinely thrilling. You're really excited to see this character do what he's so well known for doing. And part of the reason we're excited is, up to that point, the film's been pretty judicious with doling out those sorts of hero moments for Cruise. And I, you know, who knows how much of that is Cruise himself kind of acting as a producer as well as an actor. But I think that Joseph Kosinski's storytelling instinct might have had a role to play in pacing the movie in such a way that those moments feel genuinely thrilling because of what he's not done up to that point.
It's funny because that moment irritated me at first.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, okay. Because I could see it coming. Like, you can see that this particular, like, Kessel run, like you called it, is something that everybody else has determined is going to be impossible for them to do. Like, they're not going to be able to do it in the time and under the parameters and at the speeds that they need to be able to do it. So, of course, Tom Cruise can do it because Tom Cruise is the best at what he does. Mm-hmm. And I found myself deeply irritated when that moment started. And then the level of the filmmaking brought me alongside with it and made me realize, like, no, actually, this is genuinely thrilling and I'm enjoying the experience of watching this guy be ridiculously good at his job. It's a very loud movie. It's a very fast movie. But there's a clarity to the editing, I think, where you can still tell where everybody is in three-dimensional space, which is really difficult to do when you're filming dogfights. So even just on a technical level, I definitely appreciated like the level of care and time that they spend on making sure that you know exactly where every single pilot is in the air at a given time so that you can understand what level of danger they're in and what it is that they need to do next in order to be able to fulfill that mission.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I've seen Joseph Kosinski's other work, but I was pretty impressed with the filming of his with the filming of the action sequences here. The way that The editing and the sound work and the shot choices all work together to really the characters are not. They're not great characters. I think they're like you said about the first movie, they're kind of types. Mm. And for the most part, I don't think they're all that interesting qua people. But the fact that I'm not all that interested in them as people, and yet the filmmaking in these action sequences, I was genuinely stressed out for their safety. Yeah. In these moments where, you know, something goes wrong or somebody passes out, that I wanted them to be okay. And that's not in the writing, that's in the filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And that I think is, you know, all credit to Kaczynski and his collaborators.
So Kaczynski made a couple of other movies. He's made Only the Brave, which I haven't seen, Oblivion, which I haven't seen, Tron Legacy, which I absolutely love. Like, I genuinely love that movie. And I think a lot of the strengths of Tron Legacy are also that knowledge and ability to demonstrate where characters are in three-dimensional space. In Tron Legacy, obviously, it's all digital and actually fake. And there's kind of a weightlessness to it, but at the same time, you can still tell what everybody is doing, like, at any given point. So I'm glad to see him doing that same work in a very different sort of movie. Even though, I guess, does Top Gun Maverick count as sci-fi? It feels like it almost counts as sci-fi.
I mean, it's interesting because one of the other things that I liked about this movie, and something that maybe plays into what I mentioned earlier about how it kind of touches a little bit on the United States being a waning imperial power, is that you'd think that a story about, you know, fighter pilots and being in these high-tech machines would be kind of a tech fetishist dream. Mm-hmm. And probably, you know, if you know a lot about airplanes, there's probably a lot that I'm not necessarily appreciating. Mm-hmm. But I think it's telling and maybe intentional. It might just be a storytelling move just to sort of make sure that these heroes have have some sort of adversity to overcome. But it's repeatedly set up that these pilots are going to have to take aircraft that are technologically outclassed, mm-hmm, by their adversaries. And in a key sequence of the film, which is very silly, yes, towards the end, a relic from the 80s has to be called into action, mm-hmm, and put through its paces as well. I think it's interesting that this film kind of makes it clear that these artifacts of American power are kind of all that Maverick knows. Mm. And in fact, he says as much in one scene. He says, it's being a pilot isn't what I am, it's who I am. Mm. And the deep identification he has with this passion, I think it's a really good character moment for him. And it's also another way to sort of link the looming senescence, if I can be a little bit purple prose, of Tom Cruise with the looming senescence of the country that that his character serves in this film. Again, I might be reading too much into it, but I think that's it's there if you want to see it, and it's probably very intentional that Val Kilmer plays the role that he does in this film in light of that.
It's funny that you say, like, this could be a tech fetishist movie and not necessarily, like, feels like that. And I think that remove is very much on purpose. And I actually can see it kind of tied in with a couple of other, like, elements of the story. We'll get back to Val Kilmer in a little bit, I think. One thing that I find absolutely fascinating about, like, Top Gun and Top Gun Maverick is that they are movies that are about the military and about military life, but have absolutely no interest in representing that in a realistic way at all whatsoever.
They don't have much interest in the people living those lives.
No, definitely not. It's all a lot of very, like, big and grand symbolism, but, like, none of these characters speak like they're in the military. There's not enough acronyms, for one. and there's not enough, like, technological jargon and shorthand for another. And then there's also just, like, some ridiculous business where Maverick is still somehow in the military, even though he should have put on 2 stars long, long ago. That kind of, like, ruins my level of, like, belief in the movie on a certain level, just because, like, that's just not how rank in the military works. But as a storytelling like symbol, I think that it does work very well, because the Top Gun movies in particular are about myth making and the myths that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And in the case of Top Gun Maverick, it's kind of trying to cut that myth down to size a little bit. And so I think that that remove from the actual like bits and pieces of the technology, and that remove from like what it's like to actually live a life as a Navy pilot versus what it feels like or looks like to live as like a symbol of, I don't know, American exceptionalism, I think that that works so much better than if the movie had decided that it was going to be very obsessed with like the inner workings of an F-18 or something like that. I feel like that would have derailed the point of the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There, I mean, it's so interesting to notice that the one of the early scenes, kind of the scene where they lampshade this problem you mentioned about how Maverick is still, you know, at the rank that he is, mm-hmm. even though that's not the way the military really works. He's, you know, standing before Ed Harris's crusty old admiral, and Ed Harris is, you know, he's great at playing crusty, but in that scene, it's very explicitly set up that time is not on Maverick's side. That mm-hmm. he may look like Tom Cruise, but he is a fossil, according to the new world order of drones mm-hmm. and all of the tactical considerations that brings along with it, and the fact that sort of the theme of obsolete technology even maybe extends to Cruise himself, I think speaks to the way that's so easy for a military organization to view the humans in its, you know, mm-hmm. under its command as, you know, another widget or another figurine to be pushed around on a map. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that is called out in the very first scene. And yet, maybe we'll circle around to Val Kilmer now. Mm. There's others in command who don't think that way, who see Tom Cruise's character as something else.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I feel conflicted about Val Kilmer's appearance in this movie, just because he's such a presence in the original, and he's kind of relegated to the sidelines in a way that I didn't necessarily appreciate. You still get the sense that Iceman and Maverick are friends, which is kind of shocking. And you get the sense that these two people have grown up and sort of matured together with each other. But I kind of wish that I had gotten a little bit more of that almost antagonistic give and take that you get in the original movie, as opposed to this other guy is just a presence who's kind of off on the sidelines. And whenever Maverick needs to be brought back into the action, there's a plot device that's going to allow him to come back. It almost feels like Maverick is sort of being pushed around on, I don't know, a table by the filmmakers in a way, as like a character device that just didn't quite, somehow it just didn't quite work for me.
I guess I appreciated Kilmer's presence in this mostly because of the contrast that we get when they're both on screen together. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in the first movie, they're both young and beautiful and, you know, the epitome of American cockiness. Mm-hmm. In this film, there's still that history, but they kind of represent, they're foils for each other. Mm-hmm. Whereas Tom Cruise still kind of, you know, he looks a lot like his younger self from 30 years ago. Who mm-hmm. knows how that happened? Val Kilmer, he looks like his age. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very intentional that the film makes use of that to not let us get swept up in the movie star fantasy that the people on screen will be young and beautiful forever, mm-hmm. and our heroes are all young. You know, we'll all be young and beautiful, and it makes clear that, you know, some of the life goes on after the cameras stop rolling, mm-hmm. and I appreciated that. You know, even though it's a small role, Kilmer plays a kind of a pivotal role in a lot of ways in drawing that theme out to the fore. Whereas without him, I feel like Top Gun Maverick kind of would be the empty nostalgia exercise that of my worst nightmares.
Huh. Huh, interesting. Yeah, because, I mean, Iceman is kind of Maverick's foil throughout the whole original movie, too. But you're right in saying that he's kind of like, it's a different kind of foil. It's not so much different attitudes of caution versus exuberance in the first one, or like by following the rules by the book versus being a maverick, essentially. And so much more about, I don't know, the laws of physics and time kind of are always going to catch up with you. Yeah, no, I hadn't necessarily thought about that.
Yeah, well, and that's something that Iceman brings up when he's communicating with Maverick in their big scene. He mentions, you know, there's still time.
Hmm.
There's still time, even though his character is, you know, slowly succumbing to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about the fact that there's nobody who's beyond their usefulness. There's mm-hmm. no such thing. At least there should be no such thing as somebody who's just not worth anything and is simply cast aside.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that it's weird for me to find something poignant in, again, a franchise sequel to a decades-old movie, but I did find that theme to be poignant, that that time is maybe not our friend, but simply growing old is not necessarily anything to be ashamed of if you can wear it with grace. And I don't know, I just thought it was a really nice way for Kaczynski to use Val Kilmer in this film, mm-hmm. in a way that was not trying to paper over any of the time that has passed between now and the first Top Gun,
mm-hmm.
but to incorporate it and make it actually one of the more thematically interesting moments of the entire film.
It's a miracle. Top Gun aged gracefully. Who'd have
thunk it? Who knew? Listeners, that is our review of Top Gun Maverick. It is going to be out in theaters this weekend as we speak. So I'm assuming that a lot of you are going to be seeing it. It's probably, I think this is the film more so for me than Doctor Strange. This is the film
mm-hmm.
that signals the official beginning of summer blockbuster season. I think it's a strong beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So listeners, if you've had a chance to see this film, I'm very curious to know if you think I'm reading too much into this or if you are as surprised as I am by this film.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome to The Conversation, the part of the show where we share what we've been hearing from all you listeners out there in seeing and believing land, keeping the conversation about movies going. We hear from you in all sorts of ways. We
mm-hmm.
hear from you on Twitter at SeeBelievePod. We hear from you in our email inbox at seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com. Those are the places you can get a hold of us, and we had a lot of people getting a hold of us this week, Sarah.
We sure did. I took the opportunity to ask people what their favorite dad movies were, since we are talking about two extremely dad movies this particular week.
Yeah, I think we should, you know, we should share what our listeners had to say about what their favorite dad movies are.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, I think we have to have a discussion about what dad movies act like, what the definition of a dad movie is.
It's a feeling, Kevin. There's no rules. It's just
vibes.
A dad movie.
Okay.
It's definitely just vibes. No, I mean, I feel like it's any movie that has a lot to do with process and about men being very good at their jobs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So any Michael Mann movie, I feel like, counts as a good dad movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can get behind that.
Mm-hmm. And also movies about boats and warfare.
Warfare, I feel like, figures prominently as well. So what did our listeners come up with?
Abby Olchesi gave me a good boat dad movie with Master and Commander, which she says is the ultimate boat dad movie, except no substitutes. Love that pick. I'm also a Hunt for Red October person, so I will accept the occasional substitute. We also heard from Lindsay Dunn, who said The Bridge on the River Kwai, which I gather is the ultimate dad movie. I haven't seen it yet.
I mean, that's definitely going to be a watch list segment for sure. Great movie and kind of an out of the box pick. Like I was thinking kind of like, you know, Tom Clancy kind of dad movie, but Lindsay is absolutely right. That The Bridge on the River Kwai is sort of like the movie that you sit down on a Saturday afternoon with your dad or your granddad and you watch it. Yeah. And it works like gangbusters.
I feel like any David Lean movie should probably just be honorary dad movie.
Well, I mean, Brief Encounter, though, is a masterpiece, but not, it doesn't scream dad movie to me.
For sensitive dads, I think.
Sensitive dads.
Yes.
I'll take, that'll be my label. I'll be a sensitive dad.
And we also heard from Ron Sturry, who said Unforgiven, since he is a granddad. Also a good pick. Also a movie I still haven't seen, and I love revisionist westerns. So maybe another potential watch list pick.
Oh, Unforgiven is so good. Thanks for that pick, Ron. We also heard from Elijah Olson, who shared The Count of Monte Cristo and The Big Country as two potential dad movie picks. I've seen A Count of Monte Cristo. I'm not sure if it's The Count of Monte Cristo that Elijah is thinking of.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And I have not seen The Big Country at all, so that's maybe a gap for both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also heard from Christian Haymaker, who mentioned that Joseph Kosinski also directed a little movie called Only the Brave, which he thinks is a quintessential dad movie as well. So I don't know, maybe Kosinski is going to be the go-to director for dad movies in the future.
It's a pretty recent movie, if I remember right. I remember seeing some buzz about it. Yeah, Only the Brave came out in 2017, and it's about firefighters, and that feels very dad movie to me.
It's got some overlap in the cast as well. There's Miles Teller's in that film, Jennifer Connelly too. So plenty of overlap with Top Gun Maverick in that area. We also heard from Ron Sturry, switching gears a little bit away from dad movies to parallel mothers.
Hey, gender parity.
So in there our we time. Go. Listeners who heard last week's episode where we reviewed Parallel Mothers, that was Ron's Patreon pick for us that he's pledging at the $10 a month level, which allows him to select one movie every year for us to review on the air. And Parallel Mothers was his pick. So needless to say, I was really interested to know what his thoughts were on our review of that film. And he had a lot of them. Thank you, Ron, so much for your email. It was really long and thoughtful. We can't read it all on the air here, but I just want to share this one excerpt from it where he takes issue with something I said during the review. He says, Kevin, you said that you would use the term reconciliation rather than forgiveness to describe the final relationship between the two women. But when I look up that term, it sounds like more of a legal term to restore to friendship or harmony, to make consistent or congruous, to reconcile an ideal with reality, or to cause to submit to or accept something unpleasant. And Ron mentions that there's no love implied in that. He says, I think Anna went further than that, just as Christ tells us as Christians we must do, even to those who hate us. Again, I enjoyed your analysis of Parallel Mothers, even if I disagree with some of your conclusions. Keep up the good work. I will probably have a film that I will want you to review next year after I go, God willing, to the Traverse City Film Festival in July.
Looking forward to hearing that pick for
sure. Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for writing in, Ron. And for all of our listeners out there who thinks like it sounds like a pretty great deal to select one movie that we have to talk about on air, you can go over to our Patreon at patreon.com/seeing_believing_podcast. Check out the different reward tiers, but the $10 a month level, that's the one you're looking for. It's a pretty good one, as Ron can probably attest. Don't go anywhere. We're going to get back into dad movies with The Right Stuff. So now it's time for the watch list segment, the part of the show where one of us shares a movie that we have seen and love with the other person who has not yet seen it and hopefully will love it after the conversation that we're about to have. So, Sarah, for this week's segment, you picked Philip Kaufman's 1983 film, The Right Stuff, for the watch list. The Right Stuff is another movie about cocky pilots and the need for speed, except this one is based on fact. Philip Kaufman's film, which is based on journalist Tom Wolfe's nonfiction book of the same title, traces the origins of the United States space program, prime territory for dad movies, from the efforts of pilot Chuck Yeager to break the sound barrier for the first time in 1940s California, to the seven Mercury program astronauts who became the first Americans to fly in space. So, Sarah, I mean, obviously it's pretty clear why this is a fitting pairing with the Top Gun franchise in terms of its subject matter, but I'd love to know more about why you have affection for this movie in particular. Out of all the other dad movies about pilots and the golden age of space travel that would have been fitting pairings on this week's episode, why The Right Stuff?
I think it gets back to that question of myth-making, really. I think that The Right Stuff is really smart about the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that we need to tell in order to get to achieve certain goals. I think, and in this one in particular, I think The Right Stuff does a very good job of both mythologizing the astronauts who were part of the Mercury space program, but it also does a good job of interrogating why we mythologized them in the first place and why these particular men and why were they chosen over anybody else. And the character I think that actually encapsulates all of that the most for me actually isn't a character who's in the Mercury space program at all. It's the character of Chuck Yeager, who's played by Sam Shepard, absolutely beautifully. He kind of starts off in sort of a prologue section of the movie, like you'd mentioned, attempting to break the sound barrier. And then he keeps recurring, like, throughout the rest of the movie. His story's sort of folded in with the rest of the Mercury program, but long after he's stopped being a test pilot himself. And he's just kind of left, not necessarily sitting by the wayside, not necessarily like resting on his laurels, but he's watching the world go by after the world has long forgotten about him and what he's done. And the camera treats him as almost like a cowboy. Like there are a couple of sequences even where he's riding a horse through the California desert. Incredible sequence where he's riding with Glennis, his wife, and they're chasing each other throughout the desert, and everything's at sunset, and there's these strange looking Joshua trees off in the background and in the distance. And then the movie sort of derails that cowboy persona, that myth making, by dumping him in the brush. Like he literally gets thrown by his horse. And he's left to kind of dust himself off and pick himself back up again and realize, like, oh shoot, I've broken my ribs. I don't know if I'm going to be able to break the sound barrier today. As one does. And I think that the movie's very smart about presenting him both for who he was as just like a very fascinating person in his own right and a very interesting and hardworking and incredible person in his own right. And then also representing him as someone who is kind of held up as a trophy isn't the right word for it, but almost like an ideal who isn't actually a real human being on a certain level and like what that does to a person as well. So That's one of the many reasons why I like The Right Stuff.
I mean, it's interesting that you talk about the myth making of this film, because I absolutely agree with you that, I mean, probably like most, if not all, movies about the space program, there is kind of this enduring, it feels like almost in some ways the quintessential American legend, at least of the 20th century, where good old-fashioned American know-how and ingenuity came together and allowed us to do great feats. And there I don't know, and the fact that it was kind of built from very humble origins to become, obviously, the first program to reach, to put a man on the moon, that again feels very American. It's almost like a pull yourself up by your bootstraps for the space age. And yet, I think what's interesting to me about this movie is that for all that myth-making, it is surprisingly unglamorous about some aspects of the space program. I mean, we literally get a scene where Al Shepard has to wet himself because he's in a capsule and there's no bathroom. Mm-hmm. You're just going to have to either hold it or go because you're going to go into space whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And those moments where it kind of, to if you'll forgive the pun, brings the space program back down to Earth, I think does a lot to make this movie feel like it's more than just an exercise in cheerleading American, specifically American mythology, and do something in addition to that.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's definitely doing that, but it does more than that as well. And I think that for all the reasons you mentioned and more, it succeeds at that.
Mm-hmm. That scene where Al Shepard has to wet himself in the capsule, I think, also speaks to how these men weren't necessarily like considered to be people on a certain level because they were so mythologized and held up both as heroes for, I don't know, American exceptionalism. And also the scientists don't really necessarily think of them as anything other than just bodies to put into space.
Specifically monkeys.
Yes. Yeah. And they're continually compared to monkeys, and they're continually like all of their requests for why can't you put a window in the capsule, or like, why can't we have control? Like, we're pilots. We should be allowed to do our jobs instead of just being, you know, bodies that were tested to be, you know, scientifically the most exceptional people. I think that scene does a really good job of showing, how the scientists didn't necessarily think through all of the important logistics of putting a man into space, because if everything had gone smoothly, then this wouldn't have been a problem in the first place. But obviously nothing ever goes smoothly when you're strapping a man to a rocket and then launching him into space.
Yeah, there's it's interesting. And I think that this is maybe another quintessential aspect of the quote unquote dad movie is the way that these astronauts are framed as sort of it being them almost against the world. There's a press mm-hmm. corps that is just hounding them constantly, hounding them and their families.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have to talk about those families, because I think that's another thing that really sets this movie apart.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the press that's constantly hounding them. There are the government men who only want to score political points by having a photo op with the American heroes.
Mm-hmm.
There are the scientists who are sort of buffoonishly assuming that, oh, why would we need to plan for somebody needing to go to the bathroom? Or why would we have to think about a pilot possibly getting nervous about his capsule sinking into the ocean?
Yeah.
All these things and are explicitly set up in contrast to these seven men who are doing great things for their country and know what they need if only other people would just sit down and listen. And that just feels, again, just very quintessentially dad movie.
Yeah, a lot of that competence in the face of, you know, I don't know, not ideal circumstances.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, because I think that a lot of these men in the Mercury mission all kind of think of themselves as being the best of the best to begin with. And they're also made into myths and made into greatness sort of in spite of themselves in a lot of different ways too. And one of the things that I really love about this movie is they are allowed to have flaws, and they are allowed to be like not necessarily the best people in some cases. Scott Glenn, Al Shepard, his character's a racist and he's awful, and the movie calls him to task for it, but it also doesn't make it like into an object lesson in how to be a good person either. A lot of the other men are just incredibly cocky. They're the Mavericks of their day, essentially.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because Dennis Quaid in this movie was a revelation to me.
I had no idea, so
when he's first introduced, he's wearing sunglasses and he's wearing this smirk, and for a second I was like, did I misremember something? Is Tom Cruise in this movie? Because the smirk is exactly the smirk that Cruise wears mm-hmm. in Top Gun.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, I don't want to accuse Tom Cruise of being a copycat of Dennis Quaid, but it kind of seems like Dennis Quaid set the template for the uber cocky flyboy.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone after that has just been sort of playing variations on that theme. And it's a great performance.
And he's still lovable at the same time. I hate cocky people in real life, but I do love him in this. A couple of the other characters that I love probably more than Dennis Quaid's performance, although Dennis Quaid's is a very good one. I love Ed Harris in this movie so much.
I do too.
Yeah. He's just, he's good, you know, like, and I think it's very hard to portray like a well-grounded, even-keeled person who is inherently good at their core without making them kind of boring sometimes.
Without making them boring or insincere somehow.
Yes. And he's very sincere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a route. And I think kind of the moment that clinches it for me is his wife who, she has a stutter, and so she doesn't want to be in the public eye. She doesn't want to be interviewed by the press. She's under a lot of pressure from no one less than the Vice President of the United States to appear in a photo op with him and do an interview with him because obviously it'll burnish his image. And she simply refuses, and so they literally try to have John Glenn, quote-unquote, pull rank on her to try to cajole her into doing what she doesn't want to do. And he says, I'm 100% behind you. I support you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do this if you don't want to. And he basically argues the entire American government into submission on behalf of his wife. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
Ed Harris, feminist icon.
It's really great. And that's, I think... I, like you said, it's great to see a movie that's able to portray a character as good without, on one hand, turning him to a perfect saint or some sort of insincere person. No, that's just who he is, and it's so nice to see that on screen.
Annie Glenn, also played by Mary Jo Deschanel, who happens to have been married to Caleb Deschanel, who was the cinematographer for this movie.
Okay.
Yeah, and was nominated for an Oscar for it also.
Deservedly.
Incredible cinematography for this. And it's the kind that also doesn't necessarily, I feel like, call attention to it. There's not a ton that's too showy about it, but it's also not workmanlike either. I think it's doing exactly what it needs to do in order to be able to put these characters up on the pedestal that they're on this movie, but without, I don't know, trying to do too much or be too much. It's just there to showcase them and their story in some interesting ways.
It is very matter of fact in some ways, but I think that maybe the thing that I like the most about this film are some of these flight sequences that Kaufman and Deschanel shoot that almost put me in mind of the Beyond the Infinite sequence from 2001, where, for example, in the early sequence where Chuck Yeager is breaking the sound barrier, we obviously have these cuts between him in the cockpit and the airplane streaking across the sky. Mm-hmm. But then we also get essentially cockpit views where we kind of get a view of what Yeager is seeing or maybe experiencing as he's going faster than any other person has gone before in history.
Mm-hmm.
And Kaufman, it's very impressionistic. There's just a lot of colors. There's not a lot of shapes. The camera kind of tilts one way and then another, and I think it's not a literal representation of what the view out of the cockpit is, but it's very wonderful representation of probably what it felt like to just be going that fast and to not really know if the plane was going to blow up underneath you in that moment, and yet the sheer exhilaration of that speed. All of that's bundled up into those sequences, and I think that's just, it's filmic language that can't be replicated in any other way.
Yeah, like really lovely. It's almost pastel, which is a weird color to include in a color palette for this, I think. There's a lot of like gunmetal grays and like very, very hard silvers, and then a lot of the flight sequences are in like softer pastels, like you said, impressionistic. Some of them kind of look like a Monet painting.
Yeah, it's and so I think that I mean, I love Apollo 13. Apollo 13 is probably the movie that kind of got me into space movies about the space program. I think it's a strong movie, but one thing that the right stuff has that Apollo 13 doesn't have is kind of that willingness to be a little bit more experimental with the visuals, rather than simply, you know, choosing shots and storyboarding out sequences in ways that simply give us all the narrative information we need to move the story forward. Kaufman does take some time to maybe spend some time with Chuck Yeager just riding his horse across the desert, or these more impressionistic cockpit sequences, or even the scene where John Glenn sees some mysterious firefly-like lights outside of his capsule window he's orbiting the Earth.
I've been meaning to look that up to see if that actually happened, and I'm not sure. So I feel like I have failed Dads Everywhere by not doing the research.
I'm sure that if we have any listeners out there who can issue a correction on our behalf, we're all ears. But it's very telling that that's kind of really the only... That's the primary portion of John Glenn's space flight that we get. It's not, you know, him doing switches. It's it's him kind of just being in awe of being where he is, and just it's a quiet moment that leaves the techno babble aside for a second and just lets us exist in that moment with him. And I think it's not really showy in special effects either. It's pretty basic special effects, and yet it has a really great impact.
I think there's a level of romance to it, and I think that's one of the things that this movie does very well, is it gets at the level of romance of exploration and spaceflight and doing something that nobody else has ever managed to do before. And it kind of ties in with one of my other favorite sequences involving Chuck Yeager. I'm going to keep coming back to Chuck Yeager just because I love him as a character in this movie. Before he gets on the X-1 for his flight in 1947, where he finally breaks the sound barrier, he's on horseback and he's left a bar, and there's the plane being refueled in front of him. And the way that it's shot, it almost looks like a dragon. Like, it's literally shooting flames out of its tail as they're getting it ready for its flight the next day. And he's on a horse, so he just kind of comes up over a hill to look down at it, and it kind of looks like it's crouched, like it's a predator. It's a very squat, stubby plane. And he stops for a second and he regards it almost like he's locking eyes with it. And then he just goes around it and he keeps on going because he knows he's going to actually have to face off against it the next morning. And I think that level of like understated romance is what really, really works about this movie for me.
That's a really good point. That's a great way to put it. This movie is romantic about... It doesn't lose sight in its obsession with process and, you know, kind of like the more mundane aspects of space travel. It never loses sight of the fact that this is something that humanity, you know, only dreamed of before and yet was achieving in real time. Mm-hmm. And I think Kaufman's ability to capture both sides of that coin is what makes The Right Stuff a special film.
Yeah. And he does both sides incredibly well too. Like, you get just how gross and awful the military housing is for the families. Like, you get that sense of abandonment when they're no longer useful for the narrative for the Mercury story. Veronica Cartwright in this movie is absolutely fantastic as Gus Grissom's wife. And her disappointment at not being given like the same level of ticker tape parade, like, reception after he's come back and the landing's been botched and the space capsule's been lost. And I think like her level of disappointment and feeling like her sense that the military owes her because she and her family have sacrificed so much and her husband could have died. And all they can do is give them like kind of an ignominious thank you and like a hotel suite with some snacks. And that's just about it. Like, that level of disappointment feels so real and grounded as well. That it doesn't strip away any of the romance of any of the truly romantic moments, but I think it does bring them down to earth and ground them in a way that feels realistic to me.
Yeah, let's talk about the astronauts' families, because I think that's also partly to credit for what keeps this movie from being merely an exercise in self-mythologization. These women who are the kind of standing off to the side while their husbands get all the plaudits, they're making very real sacrifices as well. They're also being hounded by the press.
Mm-hmm.
They're also under a lot of pressure to sort of be the dutiful spouse and to essentially manage everything while their husbands are in space, not knowing if they're ever going to see them again.
Mm-hmm.
I think Kaufman does, he gives us a lot of time with them, and far from kind of just making them either plot devices where their dissatisfaction is sort of another obstacle to be overcome or to provide color for the men's story. Their emotions surrounding these events are just as integral a part of the story as the men's part. And that's also nice to see.
It's so much better than like the shorthand of this is the astronaut's wife and she's going to sit next to a radio and she's going to look very, very worried for the rest of the movie.
She's going to cry and she's going to be strong, but she's also, we're not interested in her.
Mm-hmm. And I think the movie's very interested in all of them.
All of them. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I agree. Well, thanks for sharing this with me. I feel like now might be the time where I have to issue an apology to Wade Bearden, my erstwhile co-host, sing the praises of The Right Stuff many moons ago, and I did not get around to seeing it until just now. So, Wade, I'm sorry it's taken me this long, but I hope that this conversation is some small way of making it up to you.
You're welcome, Wade.
Well, yeah, that's our watch list segment for this week. Next week, we've got what I think is going to be a pretty interesting episode. We're going to be talking about Alex Garland's Men.
So more dudes.
More just dudes.
More dudes next week.
More dudes. These are scary dudes, though, not heroic dudes. And I think that for any listeners who want to watch along for next week's watch list segment, I'm going to pair with a movie in which Rory Kinnear plays every male role.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pair that with a film in which Tom Noonan plays almost every male role and every female role. It's 2015's Anomalisa, directed by Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson. This is, you know, it's a quintessential Kaufman film in a lot of ways, but I think it'll make a good pairing with Men, and hopefully it'll get some more attention because this movie kind of sank without a trace when it came out in 2015, and that is a darn shame because it's very good.
Yeah, I didn't see it yet, but I'm going to see it next week, and I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, listeners, that is our episode for this week. Seeing and Believing is brought to you by the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm your host, Kevin McLenathan, and my co-host is Sarah Welch Larson. We'll see you next week on Seeing and Believing.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.